This is my mea culpa.
This is Michael Cohen, and you're listening to a special Best of Mea Culpa podcast, now on the Mighty Midas Touch Network. I want to be clear about something. I'm a witness in the election fraud case, also known as the hush money trial, of the people versus Donald Trump. Therefore, out of respect for the judicial process and to protect my own credibility, I'm not going to talk about him on this show, at least not until after my testimony. We are, however, a political broadcast, and we are in the middle of an election year, so there will be some informational and factual overlap. But expect no less than our signature brand of radical honesty, no matter what the topic. So today's Best of episode features one of my most fascinating and insightful guests. I'm referring to former White House counsel to President Richard M. Nixon, John Dean, from July of 1970 until April of 1973. Dean is an authentic witness to a history known for his role in the cover-up of the Watergate scandal and his subsequent testimony to Congress as a witness. Dean is a frequent political commentator and critic, and he is also a prolific author whose famous subjects are George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and of course, Donald Trump. Dean is here with us today to give us his insight on this current moment in history. So let's go now to that conversation. John, now that Merrick Garland did the one thing that we all hoped that he would finally do, and that's start locking up Trump's eager co-conspirators, what effect do you think this will have on the overall investigation and getting others to finally comply with these congressional subpoenas?
I would think it'd be pretty sobering, frankly, this is the first time I understand in 32 years, the Department of Justice has taken a referral and exercised its criminal jurisdiction over it, and they're going to go the distance with this one. So that's got to be a bracing experience for all those who are now have subpoenas either headed their way or they're sitting on them already. And I would think that their lawyers would tell them, hey, you don't mess around with this. Not only do you not no-show, once you're there, you got to answer the questions. And there are other laws involved, like perjury and false statements to federal officials that can also come to play. So you got to tell the truth once you're there.
Yeah. And, you know, we're very critical on mea culpa of Merrick Garland. Many people, as I had stated in my question to you, was that we have all been hoping that Merrick Garland would actually do something. He would start locking these people up, that somebody would finally hold Trump to task. And I was actually quite impressed with his response that he put out, and I'm going to quote it. Since my first day in office, I have promised Justice Department employees that together we would show the American people by word and deed that the department adheres to the rule of law, follows the facts in the law, and pursues equal justice under the law. Now, you know, today's charges reflect the department's steadfast commitment to these principles. And so, you know, today I think we're going to take it a little easy on Merrick Garland. He finally got this thing under control, because if he didn't, Congress would basically become toothless. They would basically have no power, considering without the subpoena power of Congress, what else do they really possess when you're looking for, you know, to deal with an investigation like the January 6th committee is looking?
Well, I agree with you on the impact had Garland not have acted. I don't think that Congress would have become immediately toothless. I think they would have been chewing on Merrick Garland for as long as they have power on the Hill. There was a very interesting exchange back on October 18th when Garland appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Sheldon Whitehouse quizzed him pretty hard on a lot of issues and focused early on January 8th and what he was doing and whether there were any restrictions on this investigation. And he got Garland to say at that time, there are no restrictions. that they, and then White House followed up, and you're going to follow the money and use all investigative techniques available. And Garland's answer, in essence, was going to use all the techniques you're familiar with as a former United States attorney, and some you're not familiar with, Senator, since you haven't been prosecuting cases in a long time. So I that was kind of encouraging to me that Garland is on track. He is not a, he's a, I think, a workhorse and not a show horse. So I think he's down there taking care of business. Today's evidence of it.
Yeah. And now what's your opinion as far as, like, Jeffrey Clark showed up before the committee, spent about an hour there, but declined to answer any questions. Now, we know that Mark Meadows failed to appear the other day for his deposition. What do you think now happens? Of course, you know, they're going to begin the referral process against him as well. Are they going to indict him as well? Do you think maybe now his lawyers are reaching out to the committee attorneys in order to reschedule to have him come in? Do you think he comes in and then does the same thing that Jeffrey Clark does, which is, you know, to refuse to answer any questions, plead the fifth?
Let's unpack that a little bit. First of all, Jeffrey Clark and is showing up at the committee, but apparently refusing to answer any of the questions pertinent to the subject under inquiry. That just literally is the language of the statute. Showing up doesn't get you over the hurdle of criminal or potentially criminal activity. It shows an intent, again, to defy Congress, and that has as likely a chance to stand up in a criminal prosecution as willful default, which is not showing up at all, as is what happened with Steve Bannon. So I think, you know, I think that this could go a number of ways. I think Mark Meadows has been, in quote, engaging with the committee until very recently. They're obviously, his lawyers are savvy enough to say, listen, let's try to avoid any criminal prosecution on this and give them enough to avoid that. It might also mean that both these guys have to go in front of that committee and take the Fifth Amendment and plead. Otherwise, they will end up being forced to testify. That's their best remedy. We haven't paid much attention to the criminality of what happened on January 6th. We know that, yes, the people who invaded the Capitol, but how about those who were behind the scenes? How about the Mark Meadows? How about the Steve Bannons? How about the Jeffrey Clarks? Michael, if this isn't a very broad-based conspiracy to obstruct Congress or to defraud the government, both of which are pretty serious criminal felonies, I don't know what they are. And so there's criminal conduct involved here. The only thing that sort of surprises me at this stage is that there isn't a grand jury that's busy digging this out down in the courthouse, and that these people aren't saying, please don't call me before Congress because I have criminal liability before a grand jury. And or either that or give me immunity here on Capitol Hill so I can tell you what I know. And that will, of course, immunize them downtown as far as the grand jury, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly enough, as you're well aware, I testified about 9 times before various different congressional committees. People are generally aware of the one that was public, but don't forget that there were 8 others that were behind the skiff. And one of the people that I was really, truly impressed with from the very beginning is Representative Jamie Raskin from Maryland. And I like what he turned around and he said about Steve Bannon. He goes, the grand jury in this case was presented with overwhelming and irrefutable evidence of Steve Bannon's violation of a congressional subpoena. And then he finalized by saying, the justice system of the United States is not going to tolerate these contemptuous violations of the rule of law. I mean, I don't think anybody has said it better than Jamie Raskin.
That's he is very good. He's a former professor. He's got the gift of simplifying what for some can be complex, or stating bluntly what those who don't want to listen and understand need to appreciate. And he's done so Very well. That committee it has a unique composition. First of all, the fact that there really is a unanimity amongst them to be not just nonpartisan, but to be bipartisan, but to be nonpartisan. And I think that that's become evident as they really have proceeded as a united front. The Republicans basically stiffed the committee, and the speaker asked two well-credentialed Republicans to join the committee, which they did, with Liz Cheney and Kinzinger from Illinois. So it's a bipartisan committee as well, but it's really proceeding in a nonpartisan way. And Raskin is one of the powerhouse legal minds. He and Adam Schiff are as good a lawyers as you're going to find anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, look, when you say it's nonpartisan, no matter what happens, unless Trump is exonerated, he's going to, of course, scream partisan, 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 witch hunt, witch hunt, witch hunt. And the funny thing is, you know, Steve Bannon's lawyer, this guy, Robert Costello, who actually tried to infiltrate my joint defense agreement, which was amazing. And that's all that information has already been released out there. But he told the committee that And I was blown away when I saw this, that the executive privilege belongs to President Trump and that we must accept his direction and honor his invocation of executive privilege. Now, I don't even know really what to say, which is why I'm so thankful to have you on Mea Culpa, because it's one of the few times that you're going to actually hear me tongue-tied and without comment other than, Bob, you stupid ass. I mean, are you freaking joking? Seriously? I mean, you do understand that Trump lost, executive privilege belongs to the president, and that Donald is not the president? What am I missing here?
Well, their briefs are arguing that there is some sort of residual executive privilege for a former president. This is really not totally resolved by the courts. Nixon did the same when he left office, claimed a residual executive privilege, but it was not quite 100% struck down in Nixon versus GSA. It's really kind of a bad ruling. It's kind of a confused ruling. It's the basis for the existing executive order that was issued by Barack Obama at the outset of his presidency that tried to clean it all up and said, yes, former presidents who are out of office can seek to invoke executive privilege. That's in the executive order. But it's very limited, and it's also controlled by what the incumbent president wants to do. When the incumbent president decides that he's not going to invoke executive privilege, that's really the final word, because that's what's going to be litigated now, is whether that teeny residual power of a former president to claim privilege over documents that he's already agreed under a law, existing law, the Presidential Records Act, don't belong to him. They really belong to us, all the taxpayers. That's what happened as a result of Nixon's threat to destroy his tapes. The Congress reached out, took the tapes and all of his papers that he might destroy, and said, those don't belong to you, notwithstanding the tradition since George Washington that they're going to belong to the American people. And that's the existing law, and has been that way since the Carter presidency when he signed it into law. And so Trump would have to go in under that law and say, listen, I'm not going to play by the rules here. I'm going to make some special exception for Donald Trump. That's typically his thinking, but it's not going to work. He just can't brush aside 40 years of law that's been on the books, that these papers don't belong to him even, and they're not in his possession. So good luck.
Right. Except what Donald is going to do is he's going to try to drag out the clock in hopes that the House ends up turning Republican, and then having enough clout still with the Republican Party to get enough Republicans to create enough tumult that it's going to end up just dragging on and on and on. And that's really his game. It's always been his game. Drag it on and hope to get a positive result out of the lawsuit.
Everybody knows his modus operandi now. His MO is crystal clear. That's why the trial judge, when they sought to enjoin the National Archives from turning this material over to the January 6th committee, she acted very quickly. The Court of Appeals and the three-judge panel that gave him a stay, an administrative stay, did the same. They set the hearing, the briefing schedule for the 22nd of this month and then oral arguments on the 30th. They might well, and I'd be surprised if they're not, are quietly deliberating, looking at the entire record from the lower court has been sent up. I checked the docket yesterday. They have all the papers in front of them. They're deciding how they're going to come down on this right now. And then they will be listening to hear if there's anything that comes up in oral argument that they don't anticipate. But given the quality of the oral argument in before the trial judge, Donald's got two sole practitioners who've never played in this area before representing him. He doesn't have the big league Washington lawyers on this issue. There may be some think tanks that are quietly,
which is shocking because he took $150 million from the American people in order to use for things just like this. And he still won't reach into his pocket and pay. He doesn't want to pay for anything.
No. And the quality of the lawyering he's getting is equal to what he's paying, Michael. They left an awful lot on the table in their briefs that they didn't know where to go. The oral argument was by another lawyer who hadn't briefed it, and he came on late. And the judge penned him down on a number of occasions. Nothing more important than their claim that he will be irreparably damaged if this information comes out before the January 6th committee. The judge kept pushing. Well, how's he hurt? And the lawyer couldn't say, well, he might be indicted and sent to jail based on his behavior. Couldn't say it's going to be hugely embarrassing to him how bad his behavior was. So he couldn't make an argument before the lower court at the trial level why Trump will be irreparably damaged.
He'll be irreparably damaged because ultimately the papers will show that he probably held the National Guard from coming in and assisting with the Capitol Police when the insurrection was taking place. There's no doubt that many people called him when this was going on. We need to do something. We need to do something. And he was enjoying watching all of these Trump flags, these MAGA idiots over there, you know, storming the Capitol in his name and in his honor. But, you know, John, I want to move on because there's something that I just found which was interesting and funny all at the same time. On Wednesday, in response to a tweet from Cher, and yeah, I mean Cher the singer, about the prospect of a Republican return to power, you replied, and I quote, "Take it from someone who knows. It will be far worse than you can imagine. The American experiment will have ended. May it not happen." Now, if you would do me the favor, walk my listeners and me what this would look like and what we have to do to prevent it from happening. Give us a little background on, a little juice on what this was about.
Well, Cher laid down a list of what she thought could be the horribles if indeed Republicans or Trump were reelected. I took a look at her list, which wasn't bad for a non-lawyer, but really kind of didn't envision the fact that we'd have a bunch of authoritarian personalities running the government. And we would not recognize the government because these people all don't think the law applies to them. It's really quite remarkable. So whatever worst case Cher was imagining, I want to assure her that these personalities will go way beyond that. Now, what's the risk of this happening? Right now, it's pretty high. If Democrats don't stop making their sausage in public and watching their president sink in approval ratings, first they're going to lose in 22 when the Republicans take control of Congress, and then they're going to lose in 24, regardless of who runs. So I think the the odd year election in Virginia and New Jersey should have told them they've got to get their act together sooner rather than later. The polls are telling them that they're not doing well. And I think on general congressional polls, they're so broad, they don't tell us a lot other than the fact that the incumbents are in trouble, which is enough to should be enough to stimulate them. That was the point of my tweet.
So what is it that Democrats need to do? I mean, give the advice of somebody who's worldly, scholarly, who's been down this road before. What do Democrats like Joe Biden actually have to do in order to increase those poll numbers? Because I've been critical of Biden in certain areas, right? Specifically with Merrick Garland, the DOJ, and holding Trump and his allies responsible for many of the things that they did during the administration. But I have been much less critical in regard to Afghanistan, where he got terrible marks on. I for one believe that the Afghanistan departure was actually done very well. It was organized. They moved 125,000 people out of Afghanistan. Now, of course, the Republicans want to only concentrate on the sad loss of life, those 13 individuals by the suicide bomber. But 125,000 people removed from a war zone in a period of 2 weeks. Trump couldn't have done that in 2 years. The reason, because he would never have put forth a plan, because he doesn't give a shit.
Well, not only that, he doesn't hire competent people. As we are getting these post-presidential profiles of the people he was surrounded by, he has his body man running the personnel department, over 4,000 political appointees, and all this guy's interested in are loyalty tests. It's crazy. I mean, not getting qualified people or removing qualified people. It shows Trump's how he envisions running the government. So we have a pretty good record on that, and adds to the potential nightmare if this man ever were to get back in. So what should the Democrats be doing, which was your original question? I think that they're not very good at messaging. They have actually accomplished an awful lot from picking up and running a very effective vaccination nationwide program. While, yes, Trump did get that started. He gets credit for that. But I don't think Trump could have ever gotten the administration of the vaccinations anywhere near where we are. And we're still struggling to get more people vaccinated. So as I say, Democrats are just not good at messaging. They have passed a bipartisan infrastructure bill that the Republicans are saying, well, hell, it wasn't $2 trillion like we wanted to do, we planned to do. Well, the fact of the matter is, Michael, they couldn't do it. They had it up for week after week, and we had infrastructure week with Trump. Never happened. So now we've passed it, and nobody knows how it's going to affect them. They haven't built an effective messaging machine. It should be hammering home, where these shovels are going to be digging and what bridges are going to be fixed, and thank Joe Biden and the Democrats for this. Rather, we're hearing now more squabbling about, is Joe Manchin going to vote for the big package or not? The government's really become all about Joe Manchin. The White House can control a lot of that. They can keep a disgruntled solo like Manchin happy and threatened. There is a carrot and stick routine that good White Houses use for guys like Manchin, who's just out there freelancing, and we have no idea what the Democratic plans are because of one man. What's his whim tomorrow? So I just see poor management. I see good leadership in the party. I mean, Nancy has pretty much neutered the gang, if you will, or the squad, and kept them in line. Sure, they didn't vote, but she didn't bring that bill to the floor, not knowing that 13, if not 25 or 30 Republicans were ready to come in and vote because it's so important for their districts to have all those good things that are going to happen with that infrastructure legislation. So anyway, it's messaging. It's cut out the public squabbling. corral the people like Manchin, or they're going to lose in 22 and 24 both. It's the Republicans are very good at running a tight ship. The fact that there were so few that voted to impeach this president, or the former president, the former guy, is amazing to me. But Mitch was able to keep the Senate virtually in line, save Mitt Romney, who has a conscience. And they stayed pretty unified, though, on policy. And he can pretty much move as a block. And they do. They need every one of their votes. They can't. They've been unable to get across the aisle. Well, the infrastructure bill is an exception. And there are other things like that they could be doing. I don't know why they are so inclined towards big bills. Why not do them incrementally? If they'd have done that in a dozen bills, they'd say, people say, gee whiz, look what the Biden people are doing. He's got some Republicans coming along. So anyway, there are different ways to skin it. It's easy to be an outsider and take shots at what they're doing right and wrong. But I think messaging has been miserable so far by the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget the pandemic relief package. I mean, how many people were able to keep food on their table, to keep the electricity and the heat going in their homes, you know, to keep their car payments going and so on as a result of it. And trust me, I know Trump. It didn't matter to him. And that's why, you know, he was pushing Republicans to fight even the pandemic relief package. You may remember they wanted to do X amount and then they came back with a secondary amount. But that's just Donald Trump. But I want to move on, John, for a second. Yesterday, former Watergate prosecutor Jill Wine Banks wrote the following about Judge Chutkan's decision rejecting Trump's injunctive relief. That it, and I quote, makes clear the profound importance of the Watergate SCOTUS decision that executive privilege is not absolute and yields to public's right to know, and reminds me of how crucial evidence like presidential call logs was to us. Now, first off, if you would, let's discuss the decision and specifically that she mentioned you in her decision. What was that in relation to? And second, how important do you think Trump's White House call logs will ultimately prove to be?
Well, the mention of me was with regard to the Senate Watergate Committee's effort to subpoena tapes and my conversations. She used my title. She didn't get down to a particular person, but she that was an effort by the Senate Watergate Committee to get seven of my conversations with Nixon. They lost, incidentally. And the reason they lost was because the court of appeals, the three-judge circuit or panel, said that information is already available to the Congress via the House Judiciary Committee, which was running an impeachment proceeding. So they said it was duplicative and on that basis turned down the Senate. But the larger, what Jill is talking about was U.S. versus Nixon, where the court said, yes, the special prosecutor is entitled on behalf of the grand jury, which was investigating Watergate, to get this information, particularly since it was a trial subpoena. Nixon's former chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, his former attorney general, John Mitchell, his former top policy advisor, had all been indicted and were awaiting trial when the court ruled on that. And they said, this is a trial subpoena, and we need the government needs these to fairly try these cases. What Jill is saying is, yes, they got the president's phone logs, which enable them to dig out other conversations. It's called the president's daily diary is what she's really referring to. They're published online. The Nixon ones are online. Most past presidencies have those online somewhere connected with that presidency. And they show the president's moves all day from if Trump was staying in the residence until noon every day, that's what they're going to reveal. When he called somebody from there, that will reveal that too. Won't probably reveal his cell phone calls. I'm sure that's one of the reasons he wanted to keep his cell phone. But anything that went through the White House switchboard, all that's going to be chronicled. And it's a diary that is prepared daily by Secret Service people as to the location of the president, you know, exact time he is in a location, jotted down, reported in. The White House operators do the same for all their activities. There are some secretarial people who make notes who are also picked up. And this is all collated by the National Archives, who has somebody on staff at the White House to prepare what is called the President's Daily Diary. And it's a remarkable document because it literally tracks where the president is, who he's with. And in essence, you can figure out pretty quickly what he's doing during those times. So Jill's right on. And that's obviously some of the information that is being sought by the January 6th committee.
You know, John, I can tell you what these daily log is going to look like, right? Up at 8 a.m., right? 9 a.m. in the residence watching Fox News, right? Newsmax, CNN, and MSNBC. 10 o'clock, right? Getting dressed. 11 o'clock downstairs. 12 o'clock ordering lunch into the
room. When does he do his hair in there?
Well, that's the between the 8 to 9 a.m. And that's what you're going to find. You're going to find that he was late to get downstairs, that there would never, and his, everything with him was telephone calls. But also the other day, right, the appellate court paused the release of Trump's documents, right? And you laid out the upcoming dates for the submissions and the hearings that are due to come up. And then I talked about Trump potentially running out the clock by stalling this past the midterms. Now, if this goes all the way to the Supreme Court, how long do you see that taking? And do you believe that his stacking of the court with judicial conservatives will help save his ass?
It could. The timetable right now is probably the earliest you can get a decision out of the three-judge panel will be the first week of December. That's if they're already deliberating and doing rough drafts of what they want to ultimately write, which I suspect they are. So after that, there'll be an effort, whoever loses, and I think it's clear to me based on the available law, but based on the lower court's decision that said no, that Trump can't block this information from the committee. Very strong opinion, too. Very well done, particularly given the time in which she did it. Plus, she had some of the best lawyers on these subjects who filed amicus briefs that they could save the law clerks and the judge a lot of time digging out some of this lore and law, which was important to her decision. But so how long it'll take? Early December, you get a ruling from the three-judge panel, which will be against Trump. Trump will then take it to the Supreme Court. That's the big $64,000 question. Typically, the court, there's no reason they have to take this, but are there four votes or five votes that will get it up there? I don't know. It's a real question. There's a true conservative legal scholar could have a lot of trouble taking this case on. And if they do, I'm afraid it's going to get very protracted. But how? What's that mean? That probably means at least until the end of the first, the opening term of the year in next year. So June of next summer, sometime in June would be when they end that first term, would be the likely time you'd get a decision if it goes to the Supreme Court. That's not too late for the for this committee to make use of that information, because by that time, I think they'll have had some witnesses quietly come in and give depositions, particularly given the Bannon ruling today, that they might realize that the price has just gone up for loyalty to Donald Trump.
Now, I know all about Trump's stall tactics. I did it for him for over a decade. Nothing is new when it comes to Donald Trump. It's just a regurgitation of the same shit that he was pulling at the Trump Organization, because he really believes that he is the dictator of the United States of America when he was the, you know, when he was president. So I want to give it just a thought here, and then I really am anxious for your opinion onto it. You had an interesting solution on this issue. And I quote, a grand jury can get all info Trump seeks to withhold from the January 6th inquiry. And the Senate Watergate Committee did not get giddy from Nixon via the courts, which want parties to negotiate. Trump won't. Answer, in 6 to 24 months, Trump wins by stalling. Now, if you would explain to my listeners how investigators can beat the stall and get the information it needs, because we don't have 6 to 24 months. We can't allow him to stall. The longer he stalls, the better the chances that he wins.
Yeah, I think, you know, if this information surfaces before 2022 and makes a big splash, and if Trump is as complicit as I think both you and I assume he will be proven to be, that's obviously can affect the midterms, which is, you know, what they want to avoid. But let's say this goes to the Supreme Court. Trump is not going to win at the Supreme Court. He might get a narrow adjudication on some information where it relates, does not relate to planning, for example, an insurrection. But it'll be very narrow. And all he'll have accomplished is to slow the process down. So my feeling as to what an investigator has got to do to get this information is to try to break as many witnesses as they can. This is not your typical flashy, not even close to the level of the Senate Watergate Committee, which was very public, cameras going, new stars born every day. As a result of the public attention that turned to it by the summer of 73. So that's not what's happening. This is all being done by deposition. This is not a showy undertaking. So I think if they proceed as they are, they may well crack this case largely unbeknownst to the public. Kinzinger said something today on a radio interview I heard when I was driving. That he was pressed on, had they already discovered complicity by Trump? And he dodged the question and said, we're really taking a very broad look, and I'm not going to get out in front of my skis, if you will, and disclose where we are. But he said, you know, we are looking at those kind of issues along with what we're finding startling information. It's a real eye opening about foreign governments' involvement. Now, that's a new line I hadn't heard about. And that wouldn't have happened without Trump's complicity also, Michael. So, at this point, I'm not worried that that Trump is going to succeed. I think it's highly problematic if the Supreme Court even takes this case. The justices that will get taken up there are going to be so patently political that it would further damage a court that is already damaged. This is a court that is about to dump Roe in some way or another. It's obviously something they don't even want. So whether it'll even go up to the Supreme Court is a real issue. Roberts is very sensitive to the fact that his court could be marked as just nothing but a bunch of partisan hacks that was put on there by the president, and not something that history will have any particular respect for. So that leans over him and shadows over the Supreme Court. So whether they'll first, I think it's a big hurdle to get this to the Supreme Court when there's, particularly if there's a unanimous and strong opinion at the three-judge panel level, which is very likely, and if a full en banc hearing takes place, the law just isn't there to support Trump holding this up, just not there. So they unlike the Supreme Court, they can't carve new law. They can try to twist interpretations and fill in gaps, but the Court of Appeals is very limited in what they can do, and there's just not much room for them to create anything that other than to slow the process down at this point. And they'll be hammered by that. Any of the panel who that happens, as you know, the DC circuit is overwhelmingly Democratic. There are most of the Republican judges are in senior status and would not likely participate in a full hearing of the entire court. So, I think that's what I'm hoping for, and it'll be the logical process of. The other thing is, you know, Michael, these judges all know what Trump's doing, and they don't. I don't think hold this man in very high esteem. They know that he will trash them. He loves to trash judges. That doesn't look as a threat to them. It looks to a sort of a how they must come out institutionally strong in their decisions. And the fact that he wants to trash particular judges and has done so in the past is not going to play in Trump's favor with the potential people who might want to rule for him. And that would also be true at the Supreme Court if they decide to take the case. And if they, you know, they would have to write new law that would dilute executive privilege, because it's what's at issue here is Biden's refusal to enforce it. He says there is no executive privilege. Trump is saying, well, there is for me. I'm a former president. This would weaken the concept of executive privilege. Executive privilege expanded presidential power. This would weaken presidential power. So this
brings me up to a question that I have, because I'm curious. Yesterday, you highlighted something that Lawrence Tribe said on The Last Word. And you wrote, Larry Tribe explained to Lawrence O'Donnell that with Judge Chutkan's powerful ruling on Trump's claim of executive privilege, a claim without merit, if Attorney General Garland does not act on the prosecution of Bannon for contempt of Congress, then Garland himself is obstructing Congress. Explain what you meant here, and why do you think that Merrick Garland hasn't acted to enforce the Bannon subpoena?
What I was quoting was a jaw-dropping statement by Lawrence Tribe, who isn't given to hyperbole. Garland is one of his former students, and he was saying that if the Attorney General doesn't act, he is obstructing Congress. And I thought, my God, you know, I don't know how long the AP will take to get that story out. So I had my Twitter right at my fingertips. So I paraphrased the statement and put it out, because it is a jaw dropper. And what's he mean? He means that there is statutory law that says if you obstruct Congress, you're misbehaving. If Garland refused to take action, he could be impeached for that, is what Tribe was saying, that he has to act. And now he has. We also know that from the inside reporting that he was waiting for the judge's ruling, which came down, 2 days ago?
I mean, it's funny. As I'm asking you all of these questions, all that's running through my head is what a fucking mess Donald is creating in our democracy. It's incredible that one man alone can do so much damage to our democracy, which has existed far longer than his 4 years. I mean, twice impeached president. Man, oh man. And, you know, to sit there and I'm watching, and because I'm still active in the district attorney here in the AG's case, as well as, you know, I'm familiar, of course, like everybody else, with the Georgia case and now the DC case with the presidential inaugural committee, with the theft and the stealing and the grifting and the lying and the cheating and the taxes and, you know, all the other stuff that Trump has done. That is just apparent. It's written right there. It's on a fucking silver platter, ready for somebody just to serve on him. And yet somehow or another, through stall tactics, through legal maneuvering, through the fact that, you know, he was the former president, the guy manages to escape.
He is gifted at the cons he runs and not being held responsible for them, no question. One of the since you're referring to my Twitter account, I retweeted something that Ann Coulter said that really surprised me that she would lay into him. She said, you know, I understood he was a narcissist and all the other negative traits we all know about the man. What Coulter says, what I didn't understand is how stupid he is. And that has been one of the shocks for me also. This is just not a smart man. And Michael, I think he's at the end of the rope. I think he's hanging on by threads at this point, and it could well get him this time.
Well, I don't know. You know, like I said, I'm seeing slowdowns. I don't understand. Just with the district attorney in the AG's office, I've said
Garland cannot wade in and
of
be
course not
seen
totally
as a prosecutor. The presidency, and this plays both ways. What you don't want to have happen is where a former president is attacked by an incumbent president. Then you start the tit for tat route that will truly destroy democracy if we start using criminal process after a president leaves. What I think that Garland is doing is letting this thing bubble up. The thing I'm referring to is January 6th and the insurrection, bubble up from the bottom and become so apparent as the evidence surfaces that Trump's guilt and complicity will become self-evident. And what people are really going to be voting on then is this man so anti-democratic, small d, that you could risk having him be president again? And I think hopefully that's what we will learn from the January 8th committee. That's why I'm sure Trump doesn't want this stuff out. He's been told it is not going to play well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the January 6th committee has a lot on their plate, very much no different, I hate to say it, as our Attorney General Tish James and our district attorney here, Cy Vance. They have a massive, massive role to play in the prevention of this man becoming our supreme leader, because that's all he cares about. He doesn't want to be president because he wants to do good for America. He wants to be president to line his pockets. That's all that this is about.
Stay out of jail, too.
And stay out of prison. When he sees Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, he's sitting there and he's like, I should own 25% of each and every one of their companies. No different than Putin does in Russia. He feels that he is the supreme leader. It's just a narcissistic sociopathy that nobody can explain. But I want to ask you this, John. If you had to rank those most likely to face a sedition charge, and what we're going to do right now is we're going to make something called an MSP trophy, the most seditious politician, who would you make your top three and why? Because my top three would, of course, be John Eastman, Jeffrey Clark, and Rudy Giuliani. And well, if Rudy Giuliani, being that he's not a current politician, I'll just substitute him in for Josh Hawley.
I will put one in front of your list that I think tops your list, and that's Steve Bannon, who's publicly announced he wants to destroy the administrative state. I'm sure Bannon is delighted that he has been indicted for a misdemeanor. He's willing to go to jail for a year and pay a $100,000 fine if he gets hit with the full thing, because of the attention he's going to get between now and that day, where he can again just use this as attacks on by the deep state against Trump's base that Bannon has tapped into is very much his base. He has been on this crusade to destroy democracy for decades now. The fact that he ended up as Trump's campaign manager and his White House advisor is startling. You're seeing the man for who he is. Obviously, he was sloppy. Steve was too much with multiple shirts for Donald Trump, who's a little bit more dressed up than sloppy Steve, as Donald calls him, was. But nevertheless, Trump is back fully embracing the distorted evil genius of this guy who really wants to destroy America and be known for it.
Look, let me say this to you. Right now, Steve Bannon.
But your list isn't bad. Your list is not bad. Let me tell you, those are people who are engaging in a conspiracy to overthrow democracy. No question. No question.
I mean, we got to throw Lauren Boebert into there. There's so many. Even Ted Cruz. I sit and I look at Ted Cruz in a very different way than I looked at him before. And I never liked Ted. Right. And not just because, he's a Republican and so on. I never liked him because I always found him to be arrogant and arrogant to a point where it's obnoxious. But listening to him now, making the arguments that he's making with the Nazi salute and so on, that's what Steve Bannon wants to turn this country into, an autocracy. And he knows that he'll never be the Adolf Hitler. But he'd be happy being the Goebbels or being Himmler. And that's Steve Bannon. But I want to now make a little message to Steve. Don't forget, I spent 13 months in Otisville. And in that 13 months, I got the full experience. Of course, when I first got there, I was at the satellite camp, which is like a really ugly sort of YMCA type camp. But people were absolutely fine. The food was disgusting, but I had Tony meatballs in the kitchen. So I would, I got a couple of extra favors in terms of the food and what I didn't. I would make myself a lot of tuna. You eat a lot of tuna there in the bag, which is really disgusting. But I also spent time in the SHU, which is horrific. And then I spent 51 days in solitary confinement, which was really, really bad. And I promised Steve, and I know that he did, that he saw the inside of the system as well. He's going to do a year for Donald. Rest assured, when he comes out, Donald will be saying, Steve who? Steve what? Steve? Oh, yes, Steve something or another. I know he worked for me somewhere. And so, and that's what's going to happen. He will be forgotten, and he will spend an enormous amount of time in solitary confinement. He's not going to be revered as this sort of icon individual coming into an institution, especially considering many of the inmates that are there are not thrilled with any of the things that Steve Bannon himself did. For example, the promotion of the Muslim ban. It was not an immigration ban. It was a Muslim ban. And Donald told me himself when I was in the Oval Office back in March that this was Steve Bannon and Steve Miller. White supremacists don't do so well in these smaller jails and so on. And I think Steve Bannon's going to have a very difficult time over the course of those, of those 12 months. You could rest assured.
I can't imagine what defense he's going to put up to the charges that are against him. He's got two counts. One is no show, and two for his testimony, and is no show for producing documents. And it's pretty much a slam dunk case. I think he will take it to trial because he wants the attention. He wants to say, just another witch hunt. These people are terrible. They're going after all Trump's people like me. But at some point, those people are pretty well known now. They are not more than 30% of the population. There are millions of them, but they can't take control of the system. There are not enough of them, and they'll offend more people in the process that could help, keep democracy intact. And that's where, I was listening this morning while driving to the end of Woodward's book, Peril, where he talks about how some of Trump's really remarkable behavior doesn't describe it, but I kept thinking of Ann Coulter's comment, how surprisingly stupid this guy is, too.
Yep.
He really is.
Yep. So, John, I have two more questions because, as I told you at the beginning, the hour goes by quickly. It goes by with all of my guests because there's so much to talk about and it's just so fascinating. The details of the command center set up by Trump allies to attempt to overturn the election, to me, I can only describe as chilling. It's plainly obvious that this was a coup attempt for which you wrote, and I quote, "Coups are not just tanks rolling in the street. It's an illegal attempt to overturn the will of the people to retain political power. And if the organizers of the failed coup are not punished, what's to stop them from attempting another?" Now, most people don't understand why these people are not already on trial for sedition. We watched them do this in plain sight. Everyone was glued to their televisions. They have admitted that they knew that the charges they levied were bullshit. Still, not a single person has been charged with a crime. How is this possible?
Well, it is mystifying. The fact that there is not a grand jury proceeding on this, which would solve so many production problems and eliminate some of the congressional frustration with getting the information. And while the prosecutors wouldn't be a fact-finding body for the Congress, in fact, that's what does happen. They informally do cooperate frequently with Congress. And I'm one who happens to think there should have been a grand jury long ago that is investigating this. Still may happen. There is a grand jury in the District of Columbia, but it's looking at the trespassers right now, not the organizers or the money or those who allowed the insurrection to continue by failing to act. So I think we're getting to not only the end of your program, but the end of this story. And we'll see it surface within before the Congress perchance changes hands. I think that's very much on the minds of the Democrats. Indeed, it's one of their hopes that by getting this information out, they can change minds about whether people want Republicans who want to destroy democracy back in power.
But all right, as a final question, John, let me ask you this then. Jeff Timmer, who's a former GOP operative turned Never Trump Republican and Lincoln Project consultant, tweeted a chilling statement last month, and I'm going to quote, "The Democrats have no strategy to combat Republican radicalization and sustained assault on the foundations of democracy. The media fails to even comprehend what is taking place. America is in a perilous place." Now, part of their weaponry is a vast right-wing media apparatus that is capable of pumping out toxic propaganda at an industrial rate. The Democrats have nothing like that, nor should they. But how do you fight back against a weapon that is able to saturate the country and send millions of Americans down conspiracy-ridden rabbit holes from which they never return?
I don't think there is a single answer. I think in some of the people with whom I work and converse, many of them are very prominent Republicans who do not kiss the ring with Donald, and they are quietly working in their own ways to help preserve democracy. People aren't dumb as to what's going on, and the very concerns that we all have are getting much more attention below the surface than publicly. And I think that those intentions will help preserve our democracy. And as I say, I just think that you've got to trust the good sense of people at some point. And the radicalized element of the Republican Party is not more than 33% of the electorate at this point.
Yeah, but it's not about that, because there are even Democrats right now that are so inundated with this misinformation, disinformation, propaganda that their mind becomes mush to certain issues. For example, like what we were talking about earlier, Afghanistan. Instead of, as you stated, Jen Psaki getting up there, if I was Biden, I would have Jen Psaki, with or without COVID, out there 24/7 showing the lives of 125,000 people that were taken out of Afghanistan, a place that we had been for 20 years at war. I would go to the houses of the people who received the COVID stimulus package money, showing that they're now doing okay. They're rebounding thanks to the fact that they had some money in their hands in order to feed their children, themselves, to pay, you know, to pay for electricity, heat, and so on. I mean, they do not have the apparatus. And it's funny because I started this podcast, and obviously I am progressive, right? I'm not liberal. You know, I'm sort of a moderate progressive. And if you look to see whether it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Anchor, any of them, you start to see which of the podcasts that are at the top. I happen to be at the top 3%, thanks to all of my listeners on Mea Culpa and the fantastic guests that we get. I happen to be top 3% of all news podcasts. But if you look to see who is ahead of me, because I'm usually in the 50s or high 40s, low 50s, you know, I start to look to see who's at the top of the list. And you have people like Dan Bongiorno, you have Pod Save America, you have Candace Owens, you know, you have all of these conservatives, Sean Hannity, right? You have all of these conservatives, and they are owning the airwaves, simply because maybe progressives and liberals don't listen to podcasts and they don't listen to news, but the conservatives do. And that's why you have a company like Newsmax or OAN or, you know, or Fox News that promotes this misinformation and this disinformation on a galactic scale, on a daily basis. You know, over and over and over again, until that's all that you hear and that's all that you see. There has to be something that we can do in order to save the democracy. Because if things stay this way, and if you look at 1935, it's really no different. It's misinformation, disinformation campaigns that ended up creating the Third Reich.
Michael, you, in fact, are doing it. In 9 days, you're going to even be freer, to use a phrase, to do it even more aggressively than you are. And I think what you're doing can be contagious, and it certainly is helpful.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm going to need a lot more help than just, you know, what one man can do. We really do need to continue this movement. And that's why I'm continuously stressing to people, tell your friends about the podcast. I want them to hear people like yourself who talk about the issues and talk about the issues with a sense of reality and a sense of knowledge, not partisan nonsense with the misinformation campaign going on. But John, let me thank you again for joining me on Mea Culpa. Your insight, your knowledge, you know, is just it's second to none. And so I thank you for spending the hour with me.
Always a pleasure, Michael, and enjoyable conversation. Look forward to it in the future.
The same. And thank you again, John. Be well.
Thank you.
Mea Culpa is written by Paula Killen. Our managing producer and editor is Lisa Orkin. Mea Culpa is a Midas Touch podcast, executive produced by the Midas Touch Network and LSJ Media Group.